I think is actually a pretty sound strategy for what could be a lucrative exit.
So if I were to summarize that, and great answers, by the way, this is why you're so quotable.
They could use summaries. Yeah, they could use summaries for sure. I should probably work on those.
Journalists can pick out the right sentence. I'm sure there's a good one in there.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.
Welcome, everybody. I am Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. This is episode 207. Today, I am joined with probably one of the most prolific opinion tastemakers, dare I say tastemakers, in sports betting. He's everywhere. His name is Chris Grove. Very happy to have you on the podcast today. So welcome to the pod.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. 207 is just a staggering number. Did you guys start at like 85? Was there any kind of cheat there, or
it's like the push-ups of Anchorman? You know, it's like Jake did all the hard work. I just sort of waltzed in at the end, and I'm riding off of his coattails. But it is a crazy body of work.
Yeah, it's staggering.
So what amazes me about you is like anytime, I think in the last like 6 years, I've read an article about sports betting, there's like a 90% chance you're going to be quoted in that. So how did you get so good at PR?
I think primarily just Eilers and Krejcik, right? Right place, right time in terms of the firm being one of the first to be interested in the U.S. online casino market, the daily fantasy sports market, and then, of course, primarily the legal online sports betting market. So I think there was a rush into that topic by the mainstream media post the PASPA decision. And EKG was one of the firms that was there with credible, thoughtful projections on the market size front, on the legislative rollout front. And so I think that just filled a void, got in the Rolodex from there. And then people just apparently felt good enough about the information we provided that they keep coming back.
Well, I was always very impressed. I was like, I need to learn some PR from Chris. So maybe you can give me some tips one of these days. Cool. Well, let's kick right off. So one of the things I don't know about you, which might be a different angle, is I know you principally are an investor in this space now. Is that how you categorize your job, or would you say more consultant?
It's a mix. Most of my hours go toward investing or to supporting our portfolio companies, but I still do some work with Eilers and Krejcik. The consulting work I do now is primarily focused on clients who are coming from outside of the gambling industry that are looking for the right path into the gambling industry. So if you think about media companies or hospitality companies or sports teams, other adjacent categories that have an interest in gambling but might not necessarily be comfortable navigating gambling, that's where any consulting work I do tends to focus. But yeah, 80% plus is on the investing side at this point.
Okay. So leaving aside your investment hypothesis, it might be the same. What is your sort of North Star? You know, the question I like to ask founders of any business really is like, why did you found the business? Like, what are you trying to change in the world? What is your guiding principle when it comes to betting? Like, how do you see the world and what do you want the future world to look like?
That's a big question. Obviously, just zeroing into what I want. The future world of betting to look like. We have a few different theses. I don't know what the right word is. We don't have just one North Star. We've got a couple up there in the sky, as I suspect our LPs would probably like us to, as opposed to being all in on one thesis. So I'll break it down across B2B and direct to consumer, right? So on the B2B side, we're really interested in where we see maybe the greatest room for innovation is on what we call reg tech or regulatory technology. So we're looking at things like AML monitoring with companies like Connectify. We're looking at geolocation. We're looking at KYC. There's a lot of inefficiency on the regulatory side, on the compliance side. Gambling is still very much a pen and paper industry, sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. So we're really interested in companies and have made a lot of investments in companies who go into that part of the operational stack, anything having to do with regulations, compliance, et cetera. And we see the need for those companies only growing in the U.S., by the way, right? You're someone who straddles the European market and the U.S. market. So I'm sure you have views on whether or not the European market is predictive of where the U.S. is going to go, or how predictive of where the U.S. is going to go. But regardless of where you fall granularly on that topic, I think we all agree that we're likely to see more of a regulatory burden, more of a compliance burden in the U.S. That's unlikely to recede. Status quo or accelerate is probably the direction we're going in. But happy to stop on that one and maybe to unpack a little bit before just giving the overview of the other things that we find interesting.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe a slightly different twist on that angle. Like, obviously, your remit, you know, in a capitalistic world is to return value to your shareholders. I was more sort of like, and that's interesting. And I definitely, you know, if I were an investor, like that would probably be on the whiteboard as well. I meant more like your guiding principle of like, do you give a shit about sports betting? Do you like sports betting? Do you want it to change? Do you want more of the same? Do you want it to be different? Do you think it sucks, but you make money? Or do you think it's like, what do you think? What's the man behind the man?
I have a theme I talk about a lot on that topic, and I haven't come up with exactly the right words, I think, to encapsulate it yet, but it goes something like this. If you are, let's say, 30 or under, I'm a big believer in context. Let me back up and start there. One thing that I've learned time and time again, various ways over the course of my career, is that the context that you present gambling to people within matters tremendously, right? And a couple of examples I know you're familiar with. I did a lot of work at EKG around skin gambling, right? So people gambling with Counter-Strike skins. And there was always this perception about esports fans that they weren't interested in gambling. They would never play slot machines. They would never engage in traditional gambling. And what I learned from skin gambling was they absolutely would. They would wager billions and billions of value, no problem, as long as the surface layer of it, the ephemera of it, reflected the gaming context. They definitely didn't want to take a hard right turn into a casino and start playing like Lobster Mania or Kitty Glitter or whatever. But they like gambling as long as you put it within the context of gaming. The closer it got to that context, the more comfortable they were with it. Remember when DraftKings launched casino in New Jersey, right? 6 years into a pretty small market that was already pretty competitive and immediately started putting up big numbers. In the first half a month, they put up big numbers with a very limited suite of games and then quickly accelerated to being a top three player in the market, but not in a way that was taking revenue away from anyone else in the market. Best we could tell, it was all additive, all incremental. Again, this question of context, you had a lot of players in New Jersey who were more than willing to walk into a casino as long as it didn't say casino above the door, it had to say sportsbook above the door, or DraftKings above the door. So those are a couple of examples of context, how important it can be and how it can get someone who is interested in the fundamental mechanics of a product, but disinterested by the surface appearance of the product. How you can change that surface appearance, change that context, and get them more interested or connect or ignite their underlying interest in the games. A little bit of a wind up there. I'm going to get to an answer, I promise.
I'm wound.
I'm 30 or under, and I pick up my phone, and I'm expecting to play a game. That's a pretty well-defined context at this point, right? I know what a game looks like. I know what a mobile game feels like. I understand it's maybe going to have some progression elements, multiple currency elements. Whatever. It's going to take place within a certain graphical format, certain UX, UI. There are a lot of variations on the theme, but there's a context there. My belief is that sports betting does not fit within that context at all. That the current sports betting product just absolutely requires a substantial context shift for anyone who is expecting to pick up their phone and play a game. If they pick up their phone expecting to play a game and they open a sports betting app, they have to change context in a pretty violent way in order to get into the sports betting app. So if I have a North Star or a thing that fascinates me or a thing I think should be driving the direction of the industry in the U.S., it's reducing that context switch for consumers who are picking up their phones expecting to play a game and instead getting something that is, I don't know, like an approachable spreadsheet as the primary experience.
It's a very interesting framing that you're presenting, this idea of, I guess, entertainment as a game and entertainment as betting is significant enough jump that the mental model doesn't really jive. And your investment hypothesis, if I'm putting words in your mouth, your investment hypothesis is that the big win in sports betting is to make that more of gamified and more of a less of a context switch, and then people will move into it.
Yeah, not even gamified, a game. And I think there's a difference there because gamification, I think we tend to think of that as a wrapper for an experience. It's leaderboards, it's progression, it's medals. It's taking elements of gaming and applying them to a core product. What I'm talking about is something a bit more at the heart of the sports betting experience. So not so much gamifying sports betting as building games that are powered by sports outcomes. And the other reason why I think the industry heads in this direction, we get same game parlays. That's probably the closest thing we have to a game in the U.S. sports betting experience. And that's offering operators a structural hold that is substantially better than a traditional sports betting product. And we're seeing blended structural hold tick up pretty consistently. Think about classic Nevada structural hold for sports betting, 5.5-6%. You look at national hold now, and it's closer to 9%. That's a fundamentally different product economically. So I think operators are going to continue to be incentivized to lean into that gamification. Again, not quite the right word, just rethinking the sports betting product as something that is more entertaining, higher volatility, which again, SGP checks both of those boxes, because I think they're just going to keep trying to push product in the direction of a higher and higher structural hold for a bunch of reasons, online casino and the difficulty of getting bills done, maybe chief among them.
I think it's an interesting point, and I definitely can see the sort of the thesis that you're laying out. I feel like, and I'm not a biologist, but I feel like the pleasure centers are, or at least the brain mechanics are fundamentally different with betting than it is with a game. I think when I play a game, the way I see it is more like mindlessness, like being able to zone out, you know, something to kind of tease the eyes with some flashy things, you know, kind of just to sort of like reset your, to use your word, your context of your reality and sort of escape reality. To me, betting at its kind of like primal level, at its reptilian level, is about tapping into, we are surrounded by uncertainty in everything. Like, you might get cancer tomorrow, like an anvil might fall out of the sky and hit you on the head. You might win the lottery. You might get fired from your job. And in reality, there is so much that we can't control. And I think people are remiss to talk about or acknowledge the level of luck that it plays in everybody's life, good luck and bad luck. The luck distribution is disproportionately huge influence on somebody's life, not only who their parents were and stuff like that, but like the luck about, you know, the distribution of things happening. And I think the power and seduction and I guess reptilian with sports betting is about mapping something to that unknown process, you know, like, because betting is all about chance. And there's some kind of like primal feeling that people have around chance. And that's the sort of like the part of the brain that lights up with sports betting that I think you don't get in games. So like, I'm kind of curious, like, do you follow that logic or do you think that that's completely separate?
First of all, it's a good reminder that I should move further away from the anvil factory, because that omnipresent threat of anvils dropping from the sky is something that I'm definitely under indexing on. I think that what you're saying is right for a cohort of people who are interested in sports betting. So I grew up in poker. That's my background. That's how I got into the industry. It was the very early days of online poker. And so I track a lot of these discussions back to online poker, or use online poker as a frame for appreciating or discussing them, because poker is in many ways still more familiar to people than sports betting, obviously more mature, at least in the US anyway. In poker, there is definitely that core cohort who was playing for the challenge and playing for the victory and playing for the strategic engagement. And I think you have that cohort for sports betting as well. The fun is, or not necessarily the fun, but the as you put it, is in the analysis, is in the preparation, is in the exercising of some level of control over what is fundamentally a random underlying event. Maybe it's a weighted die, but it's still a die, right, that gets thrown. But I think there are a lot of other consumers, and I think far more in the US, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 to 1 consumers who are not approaching the activity in that way whatsoever, or for whom that is maybe one ingredient in the soup, but it's one of the smallest and least important ingredients. And what they're really looking for is more of an add-on to watching the game, an add-on to their existing social experience with their friends, a way to pick up their phone and kill a few minutes. I think there are a lot of, maybe to put it more simply, there are a lot of potential sports betting customers who engage in games for reasons that are a lot closer to the psychological profile we'd apply to slot players versus, you know, professional poker players. And I think that part of the market is, I don't want to say inaccessible right now, but it's nowhere near as accessible as it could be if you put a product in front of people that was more fun on face, as opposed to you having to kind of generate the fun through deep engagement with everything surrounding the product, not the product itself, not the game itself.
Very interesting. Let's pivot to the state of the market, because I think one of the things you're very well known for is opining on how things are going. One of the things I sort of wanted to run by you is that there's a duopoly in the U.S. And going back to what you were saying about your betting, your investment hypothesis, or betting thesis rather, is, you know, kind of a picks and shovel strategy, which I think totally makes sense. And Jesse's done a great job in his podcast of finding a lot of, you know, up and coming B2C operators. Like, what's your take on the ecosystem? Do startups have a chance? And I'm more on the B2C side, not on the B2B side, because I think the B2B world is more to play for. But on the B2C side, we obviously have a duopoly right now. What's your take on that?
I think there's a lot of room for challengers on the B2C side. So let's break out a couple of different buckets. We've got challengers in adjacent categories, and maybe these aren't even challengers so much as they're complementary. Jackpocket is a great example. Obviously, lottery focused, so you're sitting next to sports betting and casino. You're not regulated or licensed in the same way that sports betting and casino are, but you're attracting a customer with substantial cross-sell potential. Maybe you're accessing a different part of the aggregate customer wallet. People maybe think about lottery and the spend there a little differently than they think about sports betting. I don't think anyone is putting sports bets in Christmas stockings. Maybe some people are, I don't know, but that is a pretty common stocking stuffer, right? The scratch off lottery ticket. You've obviously got the fantasy sports folks, we're investors in Underdog. You've got the sweepstakes folks, you've got the skill-based folks. So there's all these categories that are adjacent to the traditional regulated casino sports book and online casino verticals. I think those are going to continue to be interesting because those products can be rolled out faster. They reach different audiences for different reasons, and they create incremental top line, bottom line, and cross-sell potential for anyone who's running online casino, online sportsbook. And you see the merits of that strategy already. You talk about that duopoly. I don't think it's any coincidence that in that duopoly is the broadest product set. And arguably, although not quite as to the same extent, the broadest brand set as well. If you think about FanDuel, you got sports betting, online casino, fantasy, skill games, horse racing, and poker. And I'm probably forgetting one or two. DraftKings has a pretty similar lineup, sub rainmakers in for skill-based, right? So there's already this recognition that in that universe of adjacent products, there are going to be interesting companies, interesting brands that are built or being built, and that these make very logical acquisition targets for online casino, online sportsbook operators, because they, just again, contribute to a multi-product strategy that pays dividends across the P&L and across the enterprise. We do think there's room for challengers in the direct online casino and regulated online sportsbook space as well, primarily because I don't think any of these brands are elastic enough to meet, satisfy, resonate with the full demographic breadth and the full array of consumer needs. The U.S. is a massive market, massive. Even the current state of online casino and online sportsbook, a lot of states to go, but even in their current state, you're still talking about effectively the largest markets for regulated online gambling in the world. So the idea that you have one brand, let's take like a FanDuel, that one brand is elastic enough to be everything for everyone, and that one core product is elastic enough to be everything for everyone, I just don't think that tracks in a market that's as large as the U.S. We've seen a couple of examples, although this is in Ontario, not in the U.S., what Justin Park is building with Betty on the online casino side, and we're not investors, but I've been really impressed with Justin's ability to build ground up and to create technology and a brand and a game portfolio that's resonating with enough consumers that he's got what looks like a sustainable business, even in a very competitive and limited market like Ontario, And then, you know, on the OSB side, a company where we are investors, Sportrade, I think, is a good example of a company that is meeting a consumer need that a lot of operators just aren't interested in meeting. High stakes in play, not restricting winners. Maybe that's like a black card brand for a Caesars or a BetMGM at some point. Again, long answer to a pretty short question. You need product diversity. I think you need brand diversity. And I think for those reasons, there's actually plenty of room for companies to, I don't even necessarily say challenge DraftKings and FanDuel or BetMGM, because that is probably folly, right? Being a younger company and saying, I'm just going to do the same thing and go head to head with those companies, that is a mistake. But looking for the areas where they either can't or won't be and occupying those, I think is actually a pretty sound strategy for what could be a lucrative exit.
So if I were to summarize that, and great answers, by the way, this is why you're so quotable.
They could use summaries. Yeah, they could use summaries for sure. I should probably work on those.
Journalists can pick out the right sentence. I'm sure there's a good one in there. So if I could summarize, it's kind of attacking for like the flanking strategy you think has legs, but the full-on assault is dumb. And I was going to ask you about Sportrade because that's, I think, also in your portfolio, because they sort of have a, they're not quite head-to-head, but they are kind of more in that sort of like head-on, whereas like fantasy and casino are kind of off to the side. One of my big pet peeves, which I'm sure every listener to the podcast knows, or my big pet peeve is not the right word, rocks in my shoe, is I'm a big believer that price will drive a lot of consumer behavior at some point down the line. And my hypothesis is that all these guys are not built around low margin. Like they wouldn't be able to sustain themselves because, you know, like they're barely profitable, if they're at all profitable now, with 10, 11, 12% margin bets. So my hypothesis is that if you ever got into a price war, these guys don't have the organizational structure to compete. What do you think of that? Do you think that's crazy? Am I crazy?
I don't think it's crazy. I do wonder sometimes if we maybe over-index on how important price is to consumers in the aggregate. There's definitely a measurable and very vocal cohort that talks about price a lot and that has zero affinity, zero loyalty whatsoever, and is completely price-driven. If I back the camera out and think about some other consumer verticals, not everyone flies Spirit, right? Not everyone flies Southwest. So we have, I think, a bevy of other examples of relatively commodified experiences. The plane still gets you from A to B. The hotel still has a bed in it. The hotel room still has a bed in it. But consumers show pretty consistently that price is a consideration among a series of other considerations for, again, I don't know how exactly large the cohort is, but a meaningful and vocal cohort. It's the primary, maybe the only consideration. I think a lot of consumers will tell you that they are value conscious, they are value seeking, they're driven by price. I don't know that nearly as many actually follow through on that. I think inertia is a real thing. Switching costs are a real thing. So I think there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. The core argument, I don't think, is anything but correct. It's just a matter of how much it matters, right? When you look across the consumer base and you say, okay, yeah, we have truth here, but how many people is it true for? That's the thing I'm a little less certain about.
So to push back on that a little bit, I think, I don't know what it's like in the US, because I think we have more of a legacy carrier kind of business model. But in Europe, the number one airline, I think it's Ryanair, but it's either Ryanair or EasyJet. They're number one by passengers, profitability. You know, it's not just Spirit Air, which is kind of a small niche airline in the US, but, you know, the low cost model is the dominant model in Europe. But what would you say, like, I know maybe it's taking the metaphor too far, but if you take the hotel example or the Ryanair example, which is an absolutely horrific flying experience, what is that soft satin pillow that the duopoly is giving you that you're not getting with, you know, to me, it's the same thing. You're buying a trade, whether it's got a blue logo, a green logo, a red logo, a black logo, whatever. There's no pillow in this case. So I think, to mix the metaphors a little bit, I think it's a little bit more like Vanguard, which kind of came along and said, we're not going to charge you anything for, well, effectively nothing compared to everybody else for mutual funds. And then the assets under management over time just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, there's no pillow in Vanguard. Like, you don't get a nicer, bigger seat when you pay Merrill Lynch to do your mutual fund rather over Vanguard. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
It goes back to that in some ways, and I don't want to try and shoehorn everything into this construct, but I think it goes back to that question of context for consumers who are only there for the value and this is a transaction and they're absolutely looking to min-max, which again is a measurable part, a meaningful part of the sports betting consumer base, you're right. They will look at this through the Vanguard lens and it really just becomes about price and execution and then maybe some additional layer of like trust and credibility, right? Because I have to be sure best price alone isn't quite enough. It's going to have to be some minimum thresholds of stability, credibility, trust, et cetera. But as you start to move to the other end of that spectrum and you get to people who are looking at this more as an entertainment product, I think other factors like brand affinity, right? What brand do I think actually reflects me and who I think about myself as a person? Social reinforcement, where are my friends betting? Because I'm betting because I want to ride along with them. That's what's interesting. Or because this content creator bets there and I think that they reflect, you know, who I want to be aspirationally or who I am. What is more fun? What is easier to use? What is faster? And then again, trust, credibility, et cetera, I think actually become more important for that cohort because they are less driven by outcome. And so their risk reward assessment is just a totally different set of variables and just a totally different equation.
Got it. So one of the things that's near and dear to my heart is exchanges. What's your take on exchanges? Do you like them, hate them? I mean, I know you invested in one, but, you know, I think you teased up like the black card version for Caesars or something like that, which is kind of an interesting framing for where that should sit in the ecosystem. Yeah, what do you think about exchanges? Do you think they have a broader role to play, or are they destined to sit in the corner of the VIP lounge?
I think it can be a pretty big corner. And by the way, I don't think sitting in the corner of the VIP lounge is a pejorative, right? I think that's a pretty interesting spot to occupy in a market like the US, which is headed to 20 plus billion, right? Larger if you get California and Texas on board. And certainly then with the online casino piece, although I think that's going to be a lot more sluggish, you're looking at what appears to be, you know, round number, let's call it a 50 billion US opportunity. So if you're occupying a corner of the VIP lounge in that opportunity, you're probably doing pretty well. I think there are some challenges on the exchange side. The fact that we've gone with the state-by-state rollout has created some issues. The federal overhang of the Wire Act has created some issues. These all feel solvable, but they feel like things that have to be unpacked and that have to be solved. And that does take time, energy, effort. And I think we're in an environment right now where there's not a lot of time, energy, and effort to spare. We are still very much in what I would characterize as the ramp-up period in the U.S. But I think as we start to move, we're seeing this happen in a lot of ways, and I'm sure you're having these conversations on a regular basis, just based on where you sit in the industry. 4 or 5 years ago, right, so go back to 2018, 2019, getting a third-party integration at a major operator was impossible. There's just no room in the roadmap whatsoever. You could have something that was absolutely needle-moving on EBITDA, and you could even wave a magic wand and make it indisputable, right, that it was going to have that impact on EBITDA. And operators still wouldn't have done it because they were just faced with the challenge of launching in new state A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, standing up in each state, often with tech that wasn't proven yet. And so their priorities were far more primal in terms of, we just need to stand up a platform, make sure it doesn't fall over, and then bring as many people as we possibly can into that platform. Fast forward now 3 or 4 years, and companies like Angstrom were able to win integrations before being acquired. Companies like SimpleBet willing or able to win integrations from major operators. So we're starting to see that slack in the roadmap where it's no longer about just the absolute fundamental priorities, the things that must get done in order for the product to exist and be usable at an MVP level by consumers, and into a phase where there's, I don't want to say just an indefinite, that's not the right word, there's not an infinite amount of space in the roadmap. There's still core priorities. And look, a lot of operators are still trying to get to product parity with FanDuel and DraftKings, right? So it's not as if they're into bells and whistles yet, but there's more slack. And so there's more opportunity to think about features, bells, whistles, third-party integrations. As we get more and more slack, that's when I think the industry at large starts to move into these conversations around, oh, what are the opportunities on the margin? And again, not in a negative way, just on the margin in the sense of the fat middle has really been about core MVP product that does not fall down, getting some level of efficiency in our primary marketing channels, and just getting to some extent that is in some way defensible our unit economics dialed in. Okay, now we can start to talk about topics that are a little more speculative, a little less defined, and where there might be upside, but it's just not as clear of a transaction. I think exchanges probably fall into that category. But I also think multiple brands fall into that category. I think there are a lot of things that operators now start looking at once they have a little more breathing room, a little more spare oxygen, and aren't just working on core.
My quick take on exchanges is that, and this is the finance tech geek inside of me, is that, you know, I believe that over time, sports betting will get financialized. The speed of transactions, the margins will all get compressed, the amount of times you have to update the ticks and all these kinds of things. Where you were talking about people using pen and paper, you know, my old boss, when I was stock trading, used to talk about the people at the New York Stock Exchange eating sandwiches, managing their book. Like, things used to move very, very slowly in the stock market. And now it's, you know, however many nanoseconds or however thousands of trades are happening faster and faster. So my hypothesis is that whether or not you want an exchange B2C experience, that all major sports books will need an exchange underneath the hood. And I haven't heard anybody acknowledge that or talk about that. And so I think exchanges are, they're a solution to a problem that people don't know that they have yet. I think it's going to be the core and center of all future tech stacks for sportsbooks.
How long do you think that horizon is? I see two horizons there, right? One is the technology coming into being that allows for that kind of smoothness and efficiency. And that feels pretty inevitable to me. And that feels maybe near to medium term. That doesn't really feel long term. To me, it doesn't feel like we're that far away. The other horizon is, to your point, how long before operators realize that and prioritize it and take the necessary steps to unpack the regulatory, legal, and technical challenges. Again, all of which I think are surmountable. It's just a question of whether or not people are willing to dedicate the oxygen for the exercise.
Yeah, I think as you were talking about the different metaphors of the way people think about sports betting, I kind of had this idea of like the watch industry. I'm kind of a new watch hobbyist and I've been watching lots of watch videos. Watches are all about your price point, what kind of vision do you want, the projection of yourself, all these kinds of things. And you were talking about sports books a lot like that, like which one do I identify with? Which one do my friends use? Which ones represent my values? And I think if sports betting stays like the watch industry, I don't think that they need exchanges. Prices are going to stay high, just like watches. But my hypothesis is that sports betting would get financialized. I know not a lot of people are on that bus, but if that bus happens and it's Vanguard-ized, things get faster, cheaper, things are compressed, you know, it's trending more towards like a financial market. Then I think all the big operators are going to get caught out. So who knows which way it's going to go? The thing I'm working toward is obviously the latter, not the former, but I could be wrong.
I don't think either of us have to be wrong there, right? And this is and I don't even think we're really in opposition. Talk about...
You think the 50 billion pond is big enough for two people to swim in it or two models to swim in it?
Yeah, because I think there are a lot of different consumers swimming in it. I think a lot about the difference... Jason, if I open up an online casino app versus if I open up an online sports betting app, right? The difference between those boggles my mind, right? Because I open up online casino, typical online casinos, 600 to 2,000 games I could play spread across multiple form factors. Slots with all the derivations and variations on that. Table games, a couple dozen unique form factors there with then iterations, you know, numbering into the dozens for individual form factors. Open up a sports book and it's still basically one product, maybe two if you want to talk about some of the things that lean more in the direction of games like Akas or SGPs. So I just think we get more books on the shelf, right? I think there's plenty of room on that shelf for the highly financialized min-max, just a trading product, something close to an asset class, although it's not obviously securitized in the same way as real estate or something like that. And then on the other side of the shelf, there's room for just carnival games. Right, that are basically lotteries powered by sports outcomes that are high volatility, very low risk, high reward, very high hold. And then there are a lot of products in between. That to me, I guess, is where I see the industry going, is that diversity of product, because otherwise you do kind of stay stuck with what is a relatively narrow audience, maybe a deep pocketed and valuable audience that'll do a lot of volume, but it still is leaving a substantial amount of money on the table for no good reason. Like, you can have that highly financialized, that vanguardized product, and you can have the carnival games. You can have a lot of points in between, and I don't think any are really eating from each other's picnic basket.
That pivots nicely to the next question, which is, you did this report for the next conference, who will win and how and why, and I think your conclusion was the ones that have all the products under one roof will win.
Yep.
And one of the things that I've been very clear about, and to the point where I think we might be the only operator, or at least major operator, that doesn't have a casino offering. You know, we kind of went out of our way to not have a casino offering, not because there's anything wrong with casino. I grew up next to Mohegan Sun and love going over there. But I thought it was so antithetical to what sports betting was about that if you mix that product, it dilutes the brand. It kind of makes you more, you're definitely a gambling company. There's no passion about sport. Like, I think when Betfair lost the plot, I mean, I have a lot of hypotheses on what happened to Betfair. And granted, they went off to be a large, successful conglomerate. But the Betfair exchange and the Betfair brand, I think, had the makings to dominate sports betting. You know, they had the chance to be a very, very, very dominant player. Now the Betfair Exchange is a small corner of the sports betting industry. And one of my big hypotheses about why was when they added poker, they went from being a foreign-leaning technology company to a gambling company. And then you sort of like mindset shifts and you think about the world differently. You think about share of wallet, customers, blah, blah, blah. It kind of really changes the heart and soul of the company. So I was interested in your conclusion that you think the big winners here, I think the big winner from your presentations, DraftKings, because they just did the acquisition that kind of puts them in, from your perspective, pole position. But from my sort of, and maybe I'm a very overly theoretical niche entrepreneur, but I feel like it really screws up your brand because what do you stand for? It confuses you of like product development. You're no longer a tech company. Like, you are solidly a gambling company. What are your thoughts on that?
We'll go back to the, not the airline metaphor or analogy, but hotels, right? So I think about like a Marriott or a Hilton and the direction that these companies have gone in and the solution that they've come up with for that challenge. And I don't know that it's a perfect solution. And again, it definitely has a point where the tensile strength weakens or disappears, but the multi-brand aspect of the portfolio, right? That at Marriott, you can be anywhere from, you know, JW or Autograph at the top to W to Sheraton, and then going down to like Courtyard or Fairfield or whatever. And allowing those individual brands to have individual identities, but still benefit from all of the efficiencies of Topco, and also benefiting from the opportunity to allow consumers who do want different things at different points in their lives, whether it's a fundamentally different experience or a different price point or a different brand and how it resonates with them. And again, I don't know that that's a perfect solution. And I think for some people, all of those brands living under one Topco is dissonant and confusing and is a turnoff for them. I think that that's the solution that you're ultimately going to see DraftKings, FanDuel et al. Pursue. And DraftKings is already doing that to a degree, if you think about the success they've had with Golden Nugget. I agree with everything you're saying, by the way. I think there is an intense potential for brand dilution, consumer confusion, if you try to be too many things to too many people. That's the core of my argument for why multi-product, multi-brand is a good thing and why it's likely to drive winners, is because anyone who comes out, let's just take Caesars, not to pick on them, but anyone who comes out on the sports betting side and says, this is our brand, it's going to be the same for everyone, and we're expecting to capture a meaningful share of the national market, long-term, that feels really challenging. Interestingly, Caesars inherently gets the proposition on the casino side. That's how they operate in Vegas. They definitely go down market to up market, right? And it's how they're increasingly operating on the online casino side. They recognize that the consumer for whom Caesar's Palace is a resonant brand might not be the same consumer for whom Harrah's is a resonant brand, and that the games you offer, the promotions you offer, the experience you offer can and should be fundamentally different. So agree with your premise that at some point, you do risk brand identity, you do risk focus, you do risk resonating with consumers. My answer to it is just a little different, which is keep pulling more stuff under one Topco, but be thoughtful about not trying to put so much under one brand or one identity. You definitely do need multiple brands, multiple identities, or else, yeah, consumers at some point just look at it and go, I don't know, this is a mess. I have no idea who it's for, what it is, and so as a result, I don't know if it's for me or not, so I'm more likely to choose something that is more clearly for me.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, if you Flutter is probably the one that's executed that the best, because they just have such a stable of very well-known brands that kind of gives them a distribution over the bookshelf, as you call it. And this is the geek in me, but I try to think of all the major successful B2C companies, more on the tech side, and very few of them have multiple brands. You know, I was kind of, as you were saying that, I was thinking like Facebook. Yeah, they have Instagram and WhatsApp, but Facebook is, you know, global scale, and it took them a long time before they added the second brand of Instagram. But if you take, you know, if you just rattle off some of the biggest tech companies, I guess Google has YouTube and a few other things. But generally speaking, these big tech companies will have one brand and one product, and they just are really fucking good at this one brand and the one product. Tesla, you know, they don't have, Tesla isn't doing a Lincoln, Ford, you know, Cadillac kind of strategy. I know I mixed GM and Ford there. Sorry about that. But, you know, they're not doing a stacking brand. They're doing Tesla. And Tesla's really great, and they have the number one selling Model Y, because they decided we're going to make this the best fucking car in the world. And in many respects, I think it is one of the greatest cars in the world. So I don't know. I think it depends if it's the watch industry or if it's the tech industry. And I kind of think it's, to me, sports betting should and will become more of a tech industry. But I think right now it's more of the watch industry.
Go back to your big tech, how many brands question, right? So think about Amazon, and we can think about a couple of their sub brands that at some point maybe they considered ditching, but ultimately kept. I'll zero in on Whole Foods as an example of a brand that they kept. One, because there was a lot of brand equity, and so why destroy that brand equity? It's probably a big part of the value. Although it seemed like the primary acquisition there was really, we just want a bunch of ready-made distribution centers for perishables, right? But I'm sure they did a little bit of work and realized we've kind of moved past the point where people are willing to associate Amazon with products X, Y, and Z. Or we're losing substantial potential value if we try to stretch the brand across that. Zappos is another good example, smaller, but I think still relevant. They have built up enough brand equity. And for whatever reason, I think some of these, I won't pretend to understand where the demarcation is. But there are some products where consumers just say, I want a focused brand for that. I want to know that that's what the brand does, what the brand primarily does. You'll go back to your Tesla example. I think one of the things challenging Tesla right now is that they are starting to see that competition, again, on the margins, right, from brands that are now doing electric or hybrid, but also bring along with them an incredible focus on what the brand is and what it signals. So I think it's hard for Tesla to compete with a Porsche customer once Porsche has a Taycan or Taycan, however you say it. I don't know that that makes either approach right or wrong, but I think both approaches have been proven viable. Go back to Meta really quickly. I mean, Instagram and WhatsApp are fundamentally, WhatsApp, I think, is more of a platform play, kind of like where Telegram is going, which is one of the wildest things I think happening in our world right now is platforms like Telegram. But it is the recognition that Facebook cannot stay a young brand. It just cannot. Its audience aged with it, at least in the US. I'm not as familiar with, you know, how it functions globally. And so we need something that cannibalizes ourselves, or else someone else is going to cannibalize us. A little bit of a meandering path there, but I think there are plenty of examples on both sides of that point. And look, I think in online gambling, we'll see a multitude of approaches. I just have a preference for, given how large and diverse the US market is, I have a preference for topcos that can intelligently parcel out a number of different products across a number of different brands. I think that's what ends up winning the day in a market that's as large and as diffused as the US is.
Great. Before I let you go, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I'm wholly unqualified to do anything else at this point. I stumbled into gambling. I think you and I have talked about this before. I used to teach college, and I started playing online poker when I was teaching college. This was back when the games were really easy, and like anyone with a modicum of discipline and reading comprehension skills could make pretty good money playing online poker. Those days are gone, right? I would get absolutely slaughtered in a game right now. But I'm enjoying what I'm doing on the investing side. I've been on the operator side. I've been on the consulting side. There is something, I don't even know that rewarding is the right word. It isn't. There's something stimulating about getting to be across a number of challenges simultaneously. It might not feel that way forever. I'm sure these things are kind of cyclical for most people. But right now, really enjoying the opportunity to be working on one fire on Monday, scaling another opportunity on Tuesday, another fire on Wednesday that comes from the opportunity we tried to scale on Tuesday. And then just watching, like you said, like watching the horizon, seeing all of this money circling, gambling that is looking for a way in, whether it's the folks on the trading side, right, who view this as more of an economic opportunity in the sense of there's alpha to be captured on these trades, or whether it's consumer products that look at gambling as another way to engage or to drive marketing dollars or whatever the case is, or sports leagues and teams that look at it from a revenue evaluation, a creative perspective as well. No one cared about gambling for a long, long time in the U.S., except for casinos, right? No one cared at all. Really interesting to watch that change and to kind of stare off into the horizon and wonder how that change is going to manifest. So not really an answer to your question in a meaningful way. I'm already grown up. I'm old at this point. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my career. And the question is really, what's going to be the more narrow focus within that? But I don't think I'm ever getting out of gambling.
Awesome. Well, thanks for stopping by, Chris. Congratulations on all your success. You've done a great job building a great business and being out there, being a thought leader in the industry. So thanks for stopping by and all the best.
Yeah. Congratulations on 207. I know, you know, you weren't there for all 207, but I have a feeling you got a good shot at being there for the next 207. That'd be a long time.
Oh, my God. That's
That'd
a long be, time. That's years.
That is a long yeah. time.
That's four yeah. years. That I don't years. Know about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Maybe you could do some kind of, maybe you can blitz through a couple dozen, right? You could yeah. do some shorter form ones where you knock out a bunch in, sure. in a week.
Yeah. Some there reels. Options. All right. Cheers.
Thanks, man.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.